It's a bit difficult to remember every step, so I will try to tell it to you as best I can remember it. I was approached to do the movie based on the book, and I had turned it down. I was approached again and again and again, and I kept turning it down. And the other part, a big part, is that very few people then, and I would venture to say even now, really know anything about the subject matter of triads in America. Most people claim they don't exist. The New York Times didn't believe they existed. And a Mr. Wu, who was a member of the L.A. City Council, as I recall, was vehement in denying that triads existed. Of course, they go back centuries and centuries and centuries in China. But Mr. Wu got quite worked up about it. And I think he tried something of a crusade when the movie opened and saying that this was fabrication. And now, of course, in the years since the movie was made, the New York Times, God bless them, run regular stories about Chinese triads. But when I brought it up, of course, that didn't exist. But the old gray lady has fallen into disrepute lately, so I think we now suspect everything they write. In any case, I kept turning it down, and then I was repeatedly approached, and I said, as I recall, I will do it only if you let me do it the way I want to do it, and I would have to write it. I think they were so desperate at the time because they had spent quite a lot of money on the book. And so a deal was made, and I would do it as I saw fit. What I didn't know was that they already had a start date, or an approximate start date, fixed. And because the film was so complicated logistically and required so much research, I determined that it was not possible for me to do everything at one time. One person could not do the research, the writing, the scouting, the prep, the construction, create the design of so many of the sets. And I brought in a friend, Oliver Stone, who I think was and still is one of the great writing talents in movies. I think Oliver, Jimmy Toback, and Raymond Carver, sadly, who is not with us anymore, but I think they were three of the most wonderful screenwriters. Of course, Gore Vidal and Robert Bolt, all of whom I've worked with. And Oliver then was living in New York, kind of in retreat from Hollywood at that moment. And I approached him, and he was, at that time, he wasn't doing very much, but he had a screenplay that I had loved called Platoon. In fact, that's how we met in Hollywood. My producer, Joanne Corelli, found the screenplay, or came across the screenplay. I read it, and I loved it, and I met Oliver, and we hit it off. And Oliver was a bit off Hollywood at that moment and really wasn't that excited about plunging into something like this. I think the idea we had then was something about a cross canal, because the Chinese are moving north. By now they've completely consumed what was once Little Italy, and they're moving further and further north. You know, they're probably up to Midtown now. And the expansion of the Chinese community in New York is rather phenomenal. When we did this movie, they were then already 7 daily Chinese newspapers. There are not that many English newspapers. I think there were 3, and then the Wall Street Journal. But they had 7. And of course, now all of Queens, all of Flushing, so many boroughs of New York are completely Chinese. I think in Forest Hills is the only McDonald's in the world with writing in Chinese. There's a huge billboard in Chinese in Forest Hills. I had always, for reasons that are inexplicable, at least to myself, have had an affinity for things Chinese. And I love the people. I love working over there. I, for some reason, feel very at home with those people. They're great fun. They become great friends once you earn their friendship. And I like them. I like being around them. I had several Chinese girlfriends. They were exquisite, beautiful. And I just liked those people very, very much. And finding John Lone was very difficult. Finding all of the other people was very difficult and time-consuming. But Oliver and myself went every night to Chinatown. Chinese clubs. We didn't just interview people. We actually hung out with the one of the gangs at the time was called the Ghost Shadows. I don't know if they're still there or not. But most of the people that you see are real people from the Chinese community in New York. And I love working with non-professionals, and I've done that in all my movies, such as Deer Hunter, the character of Axel. Axel was from a real U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana. He was a supervisor. In any case, we decided to go and meet the Chinese gangsters and so-called gangsters. And I got to know them at that time as well as I knew a lot of certain mafia families, which I won't go into. But what we found was completely contrary to what all of the popular myths were. We were fascinated, both of us. We went, there's such a thing called the Chinese Gun Club. And it's really an organization which allows everybody to carry a gun. And they give equal amounts of money to both mayoral candidates every year. That's the Chinese way, you know. They would give $500,000 to Bush and $500,000 to Kerry. So whoever wins, they're kind of in with. Very clever. And we went out to nightclubs. We went drinking with them at night. And I don't think anyone can keep up with the Chinese, either in gambling or drinking. They begin with, before a meal, with brandy, the best brandy, straight out of little paper cups, those little Dixie cups, you know, that you use at the water cooler. They drink it straight brandy. And my God, they will put you under the table. Well, we went to countless dinners. We went to countless nightclubs because in New York there were Chinese nightclubs, Chinese bars all over the place. And you would go into a grungy little nightclub, and then inside it would be really glitzy and dark. And all of the kids, the gangsters in there, would be dressed like something out of a 40s movie. And I remember one night, even Oliver got up and he was dancing. And we went to the casinos because a friend of mine buses Chinese people directly from Chinatown to Atlantic City. They don't sleep. They just pile into these buses after work. He takes them right to Atlantic City. They gamble. They don't never check into a room. They get back into the buses, and he drops them back off in Chinatown the next morning. So without sleeping, they gamble all night long, and they go right back to work. We met the people that we were going to write about, so that what we eventually ended up writing about was what we knew. We weren't guessing. We weren't doing research, in a sense. We were just simply insinuating ourselves into their life and lives and their organizations. And we got to know quite famous gangsters. I mean, famous in the sense that in their area, they were as well known as a John Gotti would be, for example. And they were terrific. I just love them. I still stay in touch with them. The girl who has the red hair, Doreen, she works now in Queens. And interestingly enough, She's the one that Mickey shoots. He says, well, what do you have to say now, sweetheart? She's on the ground after this terrific chase, and she just looks at him and says, fuck you, and he shoots her, or she dies, or whatever the hell it was. I don't remember. In any event, Doreen, in addition, she's holding down two jobs now. She's doing very well. And she works as a volunteer for the survivors of 9/11. She's involved with the families and helping families, and just amazing stories that have come out of that movie. And I could talk for days just about the people and how wonderful they were. In fact, Oliver, one time we went up to Canada. Toronto has the biggest, fastest-growing Chinatown in all of North America. And it's absolutely huge, or was then. And we went with one of the leaders of the Ghost Shadows, I believe it was. And they wouldn't allow him in the country. And, of course, Oliver put up a gigantic fuss at the airport, and we had a whole little hassle with the border people. And they wouldn't let him in. He was persona non grata in Canada because his brother was the head of the gang in Toronto. So Oliver said, well, we're not coming into the country. And we did a whole thing. And he kept saying, no, no, you've got to go in. You've got to meet my brother. He has a big banquet set up. And we ended up having dinner with his brother in Toronto. He had to go back. He had to go back to New York. And here was a guy who had been, this really happened. And you can see that certain things in the movie evolve from things like this. When he was running one of the triads, one of the gangs, like the Ghost Shadows, I don't remember all the names now, but it gets a little bit confusing for me sometimes because the last movie I did was set in the ghetto of L.A., and I got to know all the black and Hispanic gangs, and so sometimes it's a cultural press, you know, you're like squeezed, like instant, total immersion, and sometimes they blend in your memory. But this kid, and when I say kids, I mean kids. I'm talking of 14, 15, even in the ghetto in L.A., when I did Sun Chaser for Warner Brothers, the average age for murder in the youth facilities is 11. Now, most people in L.A. don't know that. And if you're not in jail for murder, you might as well be in for a parking ticket. You're really discriminated against by the other inmates. And these kids, they didn't have to be taught how to shoot. They used to practice at a firing range in New Jersey. I mean, they all know each other. It's the same as the mafia. You know, everybody knows each other. It's just you're on one side of the fence or the other. And they're all human beings. And I never met a hitman who I didn't think was very, very funny. They're all very likable, hilarious guys. They all love movies. And they're funny people. Why? I have no idea, but they are. They're not at all like as they're portrayed in movies. So we went down to Atlantic City once on one of these bus things with this fellow Paul. And they had a room for us. We were going to stay overnight. So they're showing us rooms, Oliver and myself. So they show us. I said, give Oliver the best room. So they open the door, and there's this, it's the honeymoon suite, and it's all done in red. Red hearts everywhere. The bed was a giant red heart. Above the bed was a giant heart-shaped mirror. And Oliver said, this place reeks of sex. I am not staying here. And I thought, Oliver, I am so wiped out. I'll stay here. You can stay wherever they were going to put me. And I just fell on this stupid bed and went out like a light. And I don't know where they put him. We just had a lot of fun, an awful lot of fun. And as a result, I got to know people both in Hong Kong and, well, all over the world and New York on a very friendly basis, you know, and people who are still my friends today.
Why are you so concerned?
What about the ones that don't want to pay?
They call bigger
down. No, Captain.
We were writing as we were. We didn't wait because we were under the gun. I had a shooting date so that we were under pressure from day one. I was already building sets before the screenplay was finished. We were casting before the screenplay was finished. We were doing everything. for some reason, thank God, I've been very, very lucky with casting for the few films that I've made, starting with a great guy and a great friend still and a great teacher, Clint Eastwood at Warner Brothers. It was my first screenplay. Somehow I've always gotten the first actor I've given the screenplay to. Clint was the only person in the world ever to see Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, and he accepted it. Bob De Niro was the only actor who got Deer Hunter, and he accepted it. Christopherson was the only actor to see, although I had flirted with Steve McQueen, who I wanted very much to work with, but he was not well at the time. So Chris immediately, Mickey, You're the Dragon, everybody, right down to Woody Harrelson on Sun Chaser. So very good luck of the draw, you know, always able to pull out the whole card. We shot in quite a few places. We shot in New York City. We shot in North Carolina. We shot in Toronto. We shot in Vancouver. We shot in Bangkok, Thailand. We went way north of Bangkok, above Chiang Mai even, right to the border, a little place called Chiang Rai. And above that, we went to the northernmost point in Thailand. So it's quite a spread. But I found for some reason most of the work I've done has been like that. Deer Hunter is 7 or 8 different United States cities and the state of Washington, then also Bangkok, and then the River Kwai on the border of Burma. And so for me, it's become second nature to do interiors in one place, exteriors in another place. There's one scene in this movie, which we'll point out when we get to it, where the characters in one walk through 3 or 4 different countries and cities. The exterior on a walk is in New York, and the interior of a sweatshop is in Bangkok, and then they come out in Wilmington. And so I've become used to that way of working, and it's become second nature to me. I've done that on every film. And because I didn't go to film school, I didn't know any better. You know, so I didn't see anything wrong with it, so I just do it. And nobody ever told me what you couldn't do, which was the great advantage of not going to film school and not going studying writing, because nobody ever told me what you shouldn't do. And script girls are very fond of telling me, you can't, that's not going to cut. And I said, yes, it will. And they said, no, it won't. I said, how much are you prepared to bet? And they said, what do you mean? I said, I'll bet you $1,000 it cuts. And one girl took me up on the bet, one script girl, and I showed her the cut. I said, you owe me $1,000. But, of course, I didn't take it. But I don't know about this business of the eye line. And critics are always saying I cross the eye line and I do this and I do that. And I once tried reading a book about film editing. I got so confused, I had to stop reading it. I couldn't get past page 2. And yet I've worked on the editing of Deer Hunter. You know, I live in the editing room. I love the editing room. So my great break was nobody ever told me what was not possible. So I've always done exactly that. I've always been contrary. When we started writing, we started production. There was no, like, research, writing, pre-production. It was all one. It was all, you know, it was like the start of the marathon. Everybody starts running at once. So naturally, we began looking at Chinatown. And one of the reasons we ended up building Mott Street was that there are simply so many merchants in Chinatown. In one building, there can be 50 people, that to shut down Mott Street for a few days, or however long one needed it, would have cost more than the cost of the entire movie. It was not possible to shut it down. And because we had to stage this massive funeral and celebration and various things, it just could not be done. We went literally, I did and crews did and art directors and we went literally to every Chinatown in the world, practically. went to Hong Kong, Amsterdam, Vancouver, went everywhere. And I had photos brought in from every place. So the way we handled Mott Street, which is the sort of nexus of Chinatown, is that I had the designers and draftsmen, replicate that section of Mott Street right down to the grade. See, people think New York is, everything is vertical and everything is horizontal. That's not true. You might have a straight line on a building because surveyors and engineers have made it straight. But you look at any curb in New York and it's not straight. Every lamppost is leaning a little, stop signs are leaning one way. Everything is at angles. And Mott Street, believe it or not, is not flat. People think of New York as flat. Mott Street has a 14% grade. So we replicated the grade of Mott Street, and we took plaster casts of the curbstones and things so we could replicate them in this area we had. It wasn't a studio at the time. It was just a bunch of tin shacks. We literally built a studio. That's how that place got made. We did it. The studio in Wilmington. It was the best back street in America. If you look at the street of Warner Brothers down the street here, the back lot or whatever remnant is left, it's absolutely flat. It's like pool table flat. And that's why they always look unreal. If you look at Ragtime, it's flat. And that's why it doesn't look like New York, because New York is not flat. It's a very rocky little island. So what I did was, I had drawings made of every single building on both sides of Mott Street, and then I needed two cross streets, you know, to give me a backdrop if I looked either way. We probably spent as much money on signage as anything else, you know, replicating the neon signs and the lights, and there's a gazillion signs in Chinatown. And because there's so many buildings, businesses chock-a-block to one another on top, on the sides, in the basements, everywhere. And then what I did was I plugged in details from other Chinatowns because I had this massive amount of photographs from all over the world. And I even fooled Stanley Kubrick, God bless him, when I ran the movie when it was finished for Stanley in London at the studio he works at. He said, boy, he said, Michael, he said, Chinatown looks so great. I said, Stanley, it's not Chinatown. He said, what do you mean? I said, it's a set. He said, it can't be a set. That's not a set. I said, Stanley, you're from the Bronx. I said, you're a New York street kid. I said, did you ever see an arch, a painted arch like that in Chinatown? And he thought for a minute, and he said, no. I said, that's right, because that comes from Hong Kong. I said, I built that. And if you can fool Kubrick, who had the best eye in the world, you can fool anyone. And I took that as the best compliment of the set that I could ever, that I would ever get from Stanley himself. And he was just, he was so tickled that we were able to do that. It was an enormous amount of work at the time. And I explained to the producers, I said, and I had plans for a second street because I was going to put like the old Second Avenue elevated train. And I said, this thing will pay for itself over and over if you do, but they wouldn't do it. So we just built the one area. And I think, my gosh, at least 50 movies have shot there since because there was nothing better. We even had steam pipes to give you the steam coming out of the manhole covers. And so both the casting and the research for the sets, set design, took us literally all over the world, all over the world. This girl came straight from Taiwan. She couldn't speak a word of English when we started. She was so delightful. I saw her in a sleazy, really sleazy club one night, went with Oliver and a bunch of gangsters, and she was singing on the stage. And I hired her right on the spot. So she's singing the song she was singing the night I found her. By the end of the movie, she learned English, and she enrolled at Barnard. Wonderful girl.
I didn't think you'd show up.
Well, I guess I had to get a closer look at the jerk who insulted me on the...
This is all set.
Why didn't you tell me who you were?
Hostile, aren't you?
I showed up, didn't I?
Why don't you have some spare ribs?
Now, she's really in sync there. You see in the back.
Inside of a Chinese restaurant makes you feel like you're inside a motor vehicle bureau. I feel like I'm waiting for an eye test.
But, you know, the atmosphere is not the thing. Besides, I like Italian food better anyway. I'm impressed. Are you doing your homework?
Scratching the surface. So you're from Hong Kong?
No. American-born. San Francisco, the Bay Area.
How many generations have your people been here?
My great-grandfather came, worked in the railroads.
She worked as hard as she could possibly work. Ariane gave me as much as she could. You see how she's perfectly in sync the whole time?
It's a pretty sad one. Thousands of you Chinese came over here and you died building the railroads in this country. It says so right here. Their bones are scattered all over the West.
I had hundreds and hundreds of tapes of professionals and non-professionals reading the John Lone part, reading the Tracy Sue part, reading all of the parts. So it was a worldwide effort. That's why when Bernardo came to do Last Emperor, right following Year of the Dragon, we've been friends for a long time, and he called me to ask me about casting. And I said, look, Bernardo, I have just spent a year going all over the world, interviewing every actor and every possibility. And you don't have a choice. He said, what do you mean? He said, who do I use? I said, John Lone. I said, you'll get along great. It will be perfect. And the movie was a great success. And John turned out to be wonderful to work with, and he and Mickey complimented each other beautifully. It was one of those magic combinations. And they gave me what I wanted. Because of my own life experience, I wanted the bad guy to be really attractive and seductive and handsome, and I wanted the good guy to be the opposite. So I wanted to confuse the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know? And I wanted you to kind of like the bad guy and not like the good guy and be forced to like the good guy finally because of what he does, not because he's wearing a white hat. He's wearing a white hat, but, you know, a lot of good guys are bastards. And a lot of bad guys are charming. That's what I wanted. And they fit the bill. If I were a violinist, John Lone would be like a Stradivarius. I could play any note on him. Whatever I needed, he gave me. He's one of those rare actors that he was just so easy to work with. He was one of the last people to be apprenticed to the old Peking opera, where you sent the kid there. Then he spent 10 years just learning every aspect of performance. He's a great singer. In fact, in Japan, he's quite a well-known singer. He's a great dancer. He's great at martial arts. He can do damn near anything. And he and Mickey together, Mickey being an amateur fighter, knows how to throw a punch. And John, being a superb student of the Peking opera, really knows how to take one. Because if the guy doesn't know how to take a punch, the punch can look like crap, can look very weak, unless the guy knows how to take it. Taking is almost more important than throwing it. But in Mickey, I had a guy who knew how to throw a punch, so that looked good from that end. And on the other end, John knew how to take it. So the punches in that bathroom scene where they're fighting in the disco seem extremely violent and hard-hitting because they both complemented each other. Mickey could throw it, and John knew how to take it. And see, Mickey is a fighter by nature. I mean, the only reason Mickey's not a pro is he hates to train. His idea of training is smoking a cigarette, having a cup of cappuccino, espresso, and then going a couple of rounds in the ring. But on this movie, I was determined. I had an ex-Hell's Angel guy forcing him to run on the beach 2 hours in Wilmington every day in the morning and box 3 rounds with him every day because I wanted that, the physicality of the hands. And nothing's better than boxing. You know, you feel the punching, the physicality. I wanted that in the character. You see, even the way he moves through rooms, it's the opposite of John. John insinuates himself into a crowd. Mickey just busts. He's like a slugger, a battler. You know, there's no finesse. Mickey's like Joe Frazier, and John is like Ali, you know, eloquent. But nevertheless, two fighters. One's just a little slipperier. Mickey is a true original. He really is an American original. And I think part of that reason is that underneath, he's really a sweet Irish kid. He's got a very good heart, Mickey. He's a good person. He has a big, big heart. Mickey's character is based on a real cop, a Polish cop, one of the toughest cops I've ever met in my life. Has to be choreographed, otherwise you can't just, every setup is a setup. Every shot is a setup. Kid shoots himself in the foot, that is something that actually happened. It's all on the set. They didn't have to be trained. These kids knew how to use them. It's the only time I've never had to show people how to shoot.
It's all right, it's all right. It's all over now.
This is now Vancouver. This is a set, but it's a replica of the actual association in Vancouver, which is the oldest in North America. It was written in English, and then I just decided which lines I wanted them to speak in Chinese. There was no problem with the translation. That old gentleman, when he walked onto the set, he's a lawyer. He walked onto the set and he looked up at a picture above the doorway and he said, "My God, that's my father." He was so at the end of shooting the scene, we took the picture down, we all signed it, and we gave it to him as a gift.
Now, these Italian guys, 仲係好嬲關於我哋 Candy Store 嗰件事。屌你老母！我哋同你合作咗幾耐啦，仲係當我哋好似二奶仔咁嘅喎。喺我哋背後咧，佢叫我哋 Yellow Niggers。
I've always shot an anamorphic except for the two pictures I did with Doug Milsom, who wanted to use a tighter. I just liked it because the bigger the screen, the bigger the canvas you have to paint. And there was no technical reason I liked it. It's just that I liked the feeling of that wide screen. I mean, I love the West. I'm from the East, but I've came to like the West just as John Ford, who came from even further east, from Maine, and grew to be synonymous with the West. It lends itself to the Western landscape. The Western landscape is horizontal, it's not vertical. And I'm sure that when Ford was making movies, if he could have made all of his Westerns in anamorphic, he would have done so. There would be no reason not to. For some people, people are inordinately afraid of it. You can't use it for close-ups. You can't use it in a room. It's all nonsense. You do magnificent close-ups. I mean, all I need to make a movie are two lenses, the 250 zoom and the 30-millimeter lens. That's it. I don't need anything else. I think it's 250 to 10. I don't need any other lens. Just give me those two and I'll make a movie. Close-ups compose beautifully on anamorphic. And I don't know what it is. Certain cameramen just, it frightens them. You know what they think? How am I going to fill the frame? It's not a matter of how you're going to fill the frame. The frame is the world. It's how am I going to fit, not how you're going to fill the frame, but how are you going to eliminate? It's not how you're going to fill it. They see it. See, they think of the frame as empty, and now they're going to fill it with things. And so they think it's too much to fill. I look at it another way, which is, how can I best see this mountain range? How can I best see this thing? How can I? For me, it's not a restriction. It just gives me more room to work. I happen to like it very much. This movie, when you see it in anamorphic, and I hope it's going to be letterboxed when this DVD comes out, it's wonderful in anamorphic. Because when they show it on television, they just use the center and you're cutting off about 11 to 12% on either side. You're losing 20% of the picture, which is quite a lot. So if you happen to compose a shot where you have somebody in the right speaking to somebody way on the left, they're cut out. So then they get into that dreadful process of pan and scan, which is artificially redirecting the movie, which doesn't make any sense to me at all. But then again, I am not... If I haven't already said it, I will say it again. I am not a theoretician. I am not a student. I'm not a teacher. I wrote in a book I just finished. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a preacher. I'm a reacher, and that's my tune. I can't speak of movies in theoretical ways. I don't know how. And I never learned how to do any of this stuff from books or from teachers. I mean, I learned more working with Clint on Thunderbolt and Lightfoot than from any single... I've learned from working with Robert Bolt. I learned working with Gore Vidal. I learned working with Clint Eastwood. You just have to be audacious enough to say, I can do it, you know, and just put yourself in that position and believe you can. It's a bit like being a quarterback, you know. You got to believe you can hit the guy for 90 yards in the rain and the snow and the wind when about 1,000 pounds of linemen are coming to kill you. You have to believe in the impossible, you know. I think maybe Rocky Marciano said, you know, it's not who's the toughest guy or the hardest puncher, it's who can get up. And that's true of quarterbacks. Who can get up after you've been knocked flat? Who gets up and keeps playing the game? I mean, that was true of John Elway for years. I mean, he was knocked on his butt by a three-quarter ton truck 20 times every Sunday for, what, 10 or 15 years before he won the Super Bowl. Before he had a good enough team with him. But he got up. Same in movies. You're always getting knocked on your butt by something, but you got to get up. And it's one thing I learned from Clint right from the beginning. He said, Mike, you got to will things through. You will them to happen. And he's utterly right. No matter how impossible the situation, no matter how impossible the idea, your will must be strong, unshakable. You will it to happen. He believed that then. I know he believes it now, and he imparted that to me. Clint is a wonderful natural teacher because he trusts. He, you know, he's like most gamblers don't succeed because they never let their first bet be their bet. Clint does. His first bet is his bet, and then that's it. He takes a chance, he goes with it. And somehow, because he's taking a chance with you, you rise to the occasion. You know, I learned so many lessons from him, which are only now becoming clear to me. And he's never changed. It's from the first day I met him over here on the lot at Warner Brothers. This is Bangkok, Bangkok sweatshop. They're in Bangkok, these two guys. This is New York City, right? This is Wilmington. Anyway, Clint still drives up in the old Chevy pickup. The office has still got 2 inches of dust, where same place it was 20 years ago, and he's still wearing a beat-up his pool digging clothes. He's the same wonderful guy. I owe him such a debt of gratitude. I mean, this movie would not exist without Clint. Deer Hunter would not exist without Clint. I might not have ever made a movie in my life without Clint. He said, well, where did you come up with this guy? He says, I don't know. One day I looked down and there was this 12-year-old kid. He was directing a movie. And so maybe there's a lot of Clint in what I do. There's so much which has rubbed off on me from him that he's the best kind of teacher because he doesn't teach, you know, and he doesn't preach. He reaches. So you learn to reach. That's what I say. I'm not a preacher. I'm not a teacher. I'm a reacher. And that's what you want to be. But Clint is a reacher. And you could see that now in his directorial work. He keeps reaching, you know? And you think, well, fuck, if he can do that, I can do that. You know, he gives people courage by being a good leader. And it's like the army or a football team. Look at Pittsburgh today with Roethlisberger. I mean, suddenly the team has come alive. A great quarterback, a rookie, and the guy is brilliant. And the whole team rises to the occasion. You know, you bring everybody up to your level. And they respond. If you expect them to be great, they will be great, in my opinion. And that's why a lot of these non-professional actors, street people, whatever you want to call them, if you expect them to do it, they won't let you down. They'll do it. And that all comes from Clint, you know, I think, for me. I mean, for me, Clint is a very special friend. I doubt we'd even be sitting here without Clint. Clint's trusting a kid who'd written his first script. And I remember him looking at me saying, so you think you can direct a movie, huh? And I go, yeah. He said, what makes you think of this? I don't know, but I can do it. He said, okay, we'll give it a shot. So in the contract, it said after 3 days, he could fire me. My lawyer went huffing and puffing. He said, blah, 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 blah. I said, no. We got along great. We hung out together a little bit. We had so much fun on that movie. It was the best experience of my life. I didn't know it. My partner, Joanne Corelli, who's a producer, said it. She said to me, Michael, I was complaining to her about something one moment, and she said, Michael, you better take a good look and absorb this because this is as good as it gets, to borrow Jack's line. It's never going to be better. And boy, was she right, Joanne Corelli. She was so right. It never has been better. We used to laugh so much sometimes on funny scenes, you know, that we'd have to do a retake because everybody's laughing so much the camera was shaking. And I love the crew. I mean, when you have the crew, particularly the English crew, because they have such a sense of comedy and such a, you know, there's nothing like getting, good morning, Gov, first thing in the morning, you know. And in Thailand, when John arrives on horseback like an emperor into the village, the Akha village, surrounded by Bansung's troops, I had to determine how long that track would be and where it would be 6 months before we got there. So that meant that on the recce, I had the grips with me, these great English grips, Chunky Hughes and Tony Cridlin, and two of the best in the world. And I said, Tony, this is where we're going to start the track. This is where we're going to end the track. The move is going to be like this, and then I'm going to turn. We're going to do this. Right, Gov? They put stakes in the ground. Do you know, when I arrived there, that was ready. And listen to this. they put the crane on the track. You know, I looked at the shot. We had a run through. I come down, and Tony says to me, "What's wrong, Gov?" I said, "Tony, I really hate to tell you this, but we need to move it a foot this way." Okay. They moved it. And that wood was so hard, if you banging a nail on that, the nail was liable to pop out and hit your back. That's how hard it was. It's very hard wood there, real hard wood. And they moved it. Took them a couple hours, but they moved it.
This is a guy that tipped us. He calls himself Tony. Says he's been working down here 40 years.
Now, this man is not an actor. He came from Queens. He worked in a restaurant. And he spent months learning this dialogue. And he would come back every week to me at the production office in New York and give the speech. And he got better and better and better and better. I love the crew. I love the musicians. I love every aspect of it. I love doing the wardrobe. There's no part of movie making I don't like. No part. But I love all of it. I really love all of it. All of it is very difficult, but I love it. I really, really enjoy it. The night when I got the first Academy Award, I was at Western Costume then, which was then next to Paramount. I remember I was on the floor with a couple of tailors, and we were doing Christopherson's wardrobe for Heaven's Gate. I don't know what we were doing, something with his boots or his pants. And I'm on the floor, and a guy comes over to me, taps me on the shoulder. He says, "Michael, we got to go downtown." I said, "Go downtown? What are you talking about?" I said, "We're doing wardrobe." He says, no, you got to go home and put on a tux." I said, "Tux, what the fuck for? What are you talking about?" He says, "The Academy Awards." I said, "What?" He said, "The Academy Awards. I got to get you down there." I totally forgot about it. I didn't. So he drove me home. I threw on a tux, went down there. Next thing I know, I'm standing on stage next to John Wayne. I was tongue-tied. I didn't know what to say, what to do. And the next day, I was shooting. So it's like I always fell back on Clint's thing, you know? Hey, when it gets tough, just will it through, will it through. I owe such a debt to that man, and I'm so happy for his success now. I'm never afraid of someone else's success. I'm happy. When Bernardo got the Academy Award, I was thrilled. When Roman got the Academy Award, I was thrilled. I called him, and I said, "You restored dignity to the Academy." And I said, "You didn't do any interviews. You did no publicity. You don't even live here, and you won." And I remember at the moment he won, Jack Nicholson jumped out of his seat about 10 feet, straight up in the air. And I regard Roman and Bernardo as the two best living film directors in my book. I'm happy for their successes. I don't envy anyone's successes. You know, and I was very hurt by, you know, a lot of the attacks on Alexander with Oliver. You know, I'm happy when Oliver succeeds, you know. On the platoon, I said, "Oliver, you got to do this even if you have to shoot it in 16 millimeter. You've got to do it." And that's why he gave me a little credit at the end, thanks to Michael. But he did it, you know, and God bless him. And it hurts me when a friend is attacked. You know, this homosexuality crap. What's that got to do with Alexander? Everybody knows he was homosexual. Why do you have to talk about it on the news? I mean, it's recorded in history. He still conquered half the world or the whole world or whatever the hell he did. I mean, I don't know why that becomes... Well, it's like when I did Thunderbolt with Clint. They said I was homophobic. When I did Deer Hunter, they said I was a right-wing fascist. When I did Heaven's Gate, they said I was a left-wing Marxist. When I did this movie, they called me a racist. Well, which is it? Can I be all of those things? I don't think so. So... Oliver's a lot more savvy with the press than I am, and he loves it. See, I hate it. I hate dealing with the press. Oliver loves to take the press on, like he did with Natural Born Killers. You know, he loves to duke it out with them. I remember in the middle of working on this, he was furious. We were doing the screenplay, and he was furious at this review of Scarface, and he was working himself up into a rage, and he's writing this long letter to the guy who wrote it. I'm saying, "Oliver, why do you care what this Joker said. No, no, I'm, you know, he loves to fight with the press. And I hate it. I don't want to fight with them. Just let them do what they want to do. I don't care. But he's the opposite. He's the opposite. You know, when he did the JFK thing and they told him he sees a conspiracy in every crack in the wall, you know, he loves to take them on. And he loves going on TV. I hate going on TV. He loves giving interviews. I hate giving interviews. He loves everything I don't like. So we make a perfect combination. He loves that. And maybe I should do more of that, but I can't. I don't enjoy it. I don't see any point to it. These are all quite complex moves, if you notice. Everything is on a dolly. None of this is handheld. I don't like handheld cameras. You can tell instantly the difference between a handheld shot. And I don't like Steadicam. It's just a cheap way of doing a setup when you don't know how to... Anyway, I don't enjoy these superficial, made-up sort of battles. If somebody wants to talk about something deeper, I'm all for it. But you don't get that in American journalism, or rarely. I mean, you get it in Europe, but you won't get it here. Not on the level at which you would like the dialogue to take place. There's a shallowness, which journalists are now complaining themselves about. I mean, look at this debacle with Dan Rather and CBS and all of these other revelations, the New York Times scandals. Why are people doing these things? I have no idea. Why write a story that you haven't checked? Why copy somebody else's story and publish it as yours? It doesn't make sense to me. But I hope Clint's new movie goes through the roof. I'd like to see him win another Academy Award. He's so funny. I remember when he was up for Unforgiven, and I called him up to congratulate him on being nominated. I said, how do you feel? He said, I feel. He said, I'm okay, you know, no big deal. Then I ran into him. I never go to these things, but I went to the DGA dinner when they honor the nominees, or breakfast, whatever the hell it is. And you call out your name. He didn't know I was there, so everybody says who they are. So Michael Cimino, he turns around and says, Mike. So then I talked to him that night. I said, how you feeling now? He says, well, he says, I got it. Oh, he said to me, how did you feel up there? I said, man, I was so scared I couldn't open my mouth. I was so nervous. I looked out and see all these people, and I didn't know what the hell to say, especially standing next to the Duke. So then he later admitted to me, like a little kid, he says, you know, Mike, I'm getting a little nervous. He's just the best. And I wished I had been born early enough to do all of those early Westerns with him the way Ford did with John Wayne. I really envy Sergio, you know, all those movies he did with him. And I wish that is something I would have liked very much, just the way things go. But I have nothing to complain about. No complaints, no explanations.
You one silky son of a bitch. It's the way you deal with the Italians. It's the way you moved out Harry Young. How about your father-in-law, Jackie Wong? You know, rumor has it it was your hand that was on the knife that killed him. You're a smart guy, go, Joey. But you made one mistake. I'm not Italian. I'm a Polack. And I can't be bought. I'm gonna burn you down. I'm gonna drag you.
This is a tiny space. This is really, really tiny space to get those moves in. And it's not a set. It's a real room that we redecorated.
Very stupid. And you're not gonna last.
I'll last long enough to piss on your grave.
One of the guys we met had a black bodyguard. That's where I got that from. I had to meet his lawyer before I could meet him. Great guy. This is back in Greenpoint.
Donnie, what's wrong with you? I was only 20 minutes late. What's the matter with you?
Those are all old captains' houses. When those streets, you know, some of them are called Java Street, and there used to be big sailing ships at the end. And all the captains lived in those row houses. This is Toronto.
With all the girls.
Comme ci, comme ça. Hey, listen, why don't you give me a break? It's not every day I get to meet a famous person. Listen, I got a legitimate story for you.
Want some wine? White or red?
This apartment I built completely. This didn't exist. This is New York City, and this is the real, it's in an area called Dumbo, down underneath the Manhattan Bridge. It's between the Manhattan Bridge and the Brooklyn Bridge. And it's the clock tower building. If you're in New York, you can see it, the big clock. And I put this set on top of that building because I wanted a view of New York that no one had ever seen before. You know, I can't stand going to a place and shooting it the way everybody shot it before. I mean, people go to Paris and there's always the Eiffel Tower. They come to New York and it's the Plaza Hotel in Central Park. So I wanted a view of the city which would be unique and memorable.
Hey, the Chinese are always involved in something, never involved in nothing. Remember that.
Cracked, you know that? The first time I saw you, I knew
you were cracked. And a racist, too. Were you in
Vietnam? Yeah, why? None of this is green screen or any of that. It's all what you see out those windows is really what you see.
I think I even hated you before I ever met you. I hated you on TV. I hated you in Vietnam. You want to know what's destroying this country? It's not booze. It's not drugs. It's TV. It's media. It's people like you, vampires.
It's the media. It's what is being said now.
I hate the way that you make your living sticking microphones in people's faces. I hate the way you lie every night at 6 o'clock.
Ariane was a model, extraordinarily beautiful. I wanted somebody who was very Americanized, and she needed to have a certain physical look to her that would attract Mickey. It was a choice between her, after looking at thousands of people, and the girl who played in Last Emperor. I mean, she would have been marvelous, too. But this girl just seemed more American, whereas the other girl was clearly Chinese-born, you know, which is perfect for Last Emperor. She could have done this.
So why don't you invite me here?
What year are you living in? We're not in the back seat of some car to drive in. You don't have to get your money's worth.
Interestingly enough, the only person in L.A. who appreciated it was someone who generally hates everything I've done, is Sheila Benson. Because she's married to a Chinese man. And she wrote a very interesting reaction to this because she was stunned at seeing things that she knew were real. See, the one thing Sheila Benson got was the exploitation of Asians by Asians, of Chinese by Chinese. And that, she said, this is the first time she had seen something like this.
Oh, yeah. What does he do? He plays tennis and golf and goes out sailing on a yacht? What's with all these machines here? What are you, at AT&T? What, you got everybody in town jumping in and out of your bed?
You're acting like a child.
Well, a great man is one who in manhood still keeps the heart of a child.
Why don't you go home? I could see this was a big mistake.
Yeah, it was a mistake. It was a giant mistake. I'm gonna go home to a woman who at least acts like a woman. This Roger's so great. How come he didn't marry you? What's the matter? He didn't want a little slant-eyed Roger IV at Princeton?
I don't know. We've never discussed it. We just meet here to fuck.
I want to arrest the gang members for loitering, spitting in the gutter, anything.
What about the civil rights?
This is back in Wilmington.
I want the honchos around here to go apeshit.
This is a very complex move. Watch the move here. Only Alex could do something like this.
Do you understand me? I want chaos.
There's no cuts.
You know, you people, you're starting to look like the Chicago Cubs. I'm not kidding. You look like you already lost.
That's Oliver.
The world has fucked you over.
He loved that Chicago Cubs thing.
I know. I've been there. I've been in the job 15 years. I know all the stories. My heart has been broken 100 times. I've got scar tissue on my soul.
This is about a 4-minute scene in one take.
Let me tell you something. I give a shit. I'm going to make you people give a shit. I don't care what you think.
It's not just back and forth.
You guys are going to go through the numbers on this one. Now that's it. Get out of here. Whoa! One last thing.
Watch this.
The next cop that I hear about who's taking money in this precinct, I'm going to personally bust him out.
It's effortless, but it was acrobatic to do it on the dolly. It was one take. I think it was one morning. It was either a morning or an afternoon. This is out on the set again. Typical New York, a car is being towed away.
And the most decorated cop in New York City has declared war on Chinatown. Today there were 43 gang arrests, 3 gambling parlors raided, 6 sweatshops busted, and now in an opening blow at the man who's been called the godfather of Chinatown, Joey Tai. Captain White has padlocked his restaurant.
In previous years, I'd spent a lot of time with female reporters, in L.A. particularly, going around with them. I went on a number of FBI ride-alongs with girl reporters, and it fascinated me how ferocious they were in getting their story. There's a missing line at the end of the movie, which we put in, and for some reason, which is inexplicable, because the studio absolutely loved this movie. In fact, they begged the producer to make it their Christmas movie. They were right, because they needed time to educate America. It's like when Lawrence came out, nobody knew who Lawrence was. So you had to educate the potential audience, and then the audience was there for Lawrence. And while the movie was a huge hit, abroad, it was very big in New York and very big in L.A. It was a bit soft in the middle of the country, and that's what the studio kept saying. We need time to work that, and of course the producers were just so hungry to get it out. And the only change they asked me to make, which to me, until this day, is inexplicable, because I think it sums up the movie, and it has to do with the character of Tracy Sue. And I believe it's true. At the very end of the movie, there's another fight that breaks out on Mott Street during a funeral parade for Joey Tai. And Mickey, of course, is in the middle of the melee as always. His arm is broken from the previous chase. And Tracy runs in and picks him up off the ground. They both look like some survivors of a war. And the camera is closing in on them. And there's a last line. If you look at it closely, you see that they're not saying the line that they've been given to say. The last line of the movie was a great line, was Mickey says, he looks at her and he says, well, I guess if you fight a war long enough, you end up marrying the enemy. Well, Oliver himself is married to a Vietnamese girl right now. I'm sure you're going to see Americans with Iraqi women at some point. I mean, it's just something that happens. It happened in World War II when you think of all the men who married Japanese women. And for reasons that I can't understand, that line was not acceptable, and I don't understand why. So I took a line from some other place in the movie and I slipped it in, and it doesn't make any sense at all. But that is the real line, and that's what the movie's about. If you fight a war long enough, you do end up marrying the enemy. It's happened throughout history, and it will happen in future history.
And at a reduced fee, something like 17 or 18%. The rest stays with us till we weigh other offers.
Jackie Wan made these arrangements with me. We were
this guy, to the left, I brought him down from New York.
I don't see why anything should change now.
Because Jackie Wan is dead. And Harry Young has stepped down, and I am the Chaw Gun now.
Hey, Joey.
And I say we can't afford to sell to old man the old way.
You know, Fred, in all my years, nobody, and I mean nobody's ever talked to me like that. Nobody.
This is Bill, and I reproduced Lanza's restaurant in New York. It's a downtown Italian restaurant. And the waiter's not an actor. His name is Bruno. He works at my favorite place in New York. And he would say to me for years, Mr. Cimino, when will you put me in a movie? So I finally said, Bruno, come on down. He said, should I wear? I said, just bring the tux you wear every night. And when we did the scene, he said, what do I do? He's great, big, tall, 6'3" or 6'4" man. And I said, just do what you normally do, Bruno, when I have dinner. So I didn't even have to do anything. He just walked around and did what he normally does.
Hey,
this, of course, is New York on the Brooklyn Bridge. Now we're on a real New York street. This is really New York for New York. Now we're back on a set in Wilmington.
Mostly financial talk, Captain. There's mention of some problem in Thailand.
In China, there were these old English nuns.
I'm not quite sure about what. But he's very angry about a group from Toronto that calls itself the Namsung.
Sister, you got to be more precise.
It's going to be very difficult, Captain. It's been many years since we've heard the Hakka dialect spoken. They're talking around things, not about them.
Damn it, sister, that's the point. They're not going to spell it out.
The Manchu, the Cantonese, and the Hakka. Those are the three major dialects in China. There are many, many more.
You look like you don't eat enough to keep a bird alive. Why don't you have some real food?
Captain White, I've managed to live 75 years without your help, eating precisely what I'm eating now. My body fat is 12%. My blood pressure is 120 over 80. My lymphocyte count is 22%. And if you want to compare white blood cells and red blood cells, I might even outlast you, Captain, red meat eater that you obviously are.
It's New York again.
Copy that.
The perpetrator is saying he's flying into Bangkok next week. He's flying under another name.
Okay, he's making his move. I want you to get the DEA on his tail. Call the Bangkok police, whatever you got to do to eyeball this scumbag while he's over there. I'm sorry, sister.
She was lovely.
I just wish the fuck I could go there myself. Come on, back on the street.
That'll be the day the NYPD brings to Hong Kong, huh?
You guys are doing a great job. It up. Rizzo, come on.
I want you to hit Chinatown like Genghis Khan. I want restaurant health violations, immigration busts.
You're only meant to shake up the gang, kids, not turn the whole goddamn city upside down.
Let me make this real clear to you right here and now. Joey Tye goes to the Manhattan Borough President, who he contributes $100,000 a year to, right? The Borough President goes to the mayor goes to me, and the word is lay off. That is the way
that's the way it works, the way he just told you.
Wiretaps on Joey Tye. And you don't go to the Drug Enforcement Agency. Going to outside agencies isn't your job. It is Lou's job.
And what about the Dead Tourists Commissioner, huh? I guess they don't add up to a can of sardines, do they? You know, you change your tune pretty fast just because that slime bag is having tea with the mayor.
You can't link Joey Tye to that. You know it. The point here is you cease and desist.
Hey, what if I don't, huh? What are you going to do? You going to suspend me? What's that going to look like in the papers, Commissioner? You tell me. First, you suspend the most decorated cop in the city. Second, you call off an investigation into the Chinese mafia.
What investigation? What Chinese mafia? The investigation's in your mind.
What's it going to look like? You tell me, Commissioner. Your department's going to look like shit, that's what.
You trying to blackmail me, Mike?
Yeah, you call it what you want. I've been swallowing the bullshit around here for 10 years, and I'm choking on it.
You ever think about your pension, right?
Fuck the pension. That's what's wrong with this whole goddamn police department. Everybody's so worried about their pension.
Stanley.
Oh.
Never in the history of the department have I ever heard anything like this. This is a fucking disgrace.
This is a fucking war, and I'm not going to lose it. Not this one.
Not over.
Not this one. We lost Vietnam, but we're not going to lose this one. See? Nobody wants to win. Flat out win.
Just... flat out win, do they, Lou?
You go to the press again, White. You know what you're doing? You're putting a gun to my head, Stanley.
I'm very pleased that the movie still seems so fresh. It feels as though it were just shot and just released. I think part of that may be due, if I'm right, part of that may be due to the fact that what is being talked about, what is being enacted or dramatized is real. It's about real things, real feelings, but it's not just realism. It's more than realism. It's a kind of a supra-realism in order to make it, of course, interesting for an audience. But underlying the imagery, the staging, everything, are real relationships, real people talking about real things. And that has always been my interest in movies. I mean, the context of the movie is really incidental. It's the human drama. It's always about, for me, the people, the characters' dilemma, the characters' relationships, what the characters want, what they're... I guess you would say in journalese, you know, that what I do is character-driven. I find it very hard to write until I have the name of the character right. De Niro once said to me, he said, Michael, you always have great names for your characters. I said, well, I work very hard at getting that. As I said, you start with characters. And I don't believe you have a story if you don't have characters, because the story comes out of the characters in the context in which the characters live. When I was in Bangkok, you know, I think we were the first film to go there and started the film commission. And I think sometimes the thing you do before the thing finds a way of leading you to the next project in a way. I mean... I had so much of Vietnam in my head, which all had to be done by research. I had listened to so many tapes of vets telling their stories and wives, and I looked at so much footage. And when I got to Bangkok, there were so many Americans living there who just could not shake the war. They couldn't get by it. And I went to there's a warehouse down towards San Diego which repairs wheelchairs. It's enormous. It's like five airplane hangars, and there's tens of thousands of wheelchairs. And there are these communities of vets that eventually migrate down to Mexico because of the climate, amputees. And when we shot the hospital scenes, that was in a real hospital in Cleveland. It was a real spinal ward. And you just become so inspired by the people you meet. There was something so unresolved about Vietnam and all the people who participated, whether they were journalists or whether they were combatants, that somehow it seemed to lead to this, a guy who couldn't let it go. I spent so much time with cops and guys on the other side, so much time in prisons, and they inspire me because in prisons you find guys who are incredibly intelligent. I never met a dumbbell in prison, black or white. And as I said, I never met a hitman I didn't like. But these vets who came out of Vietnam, of which Oliver was one, I guess he came away better than most, but the ones that I met seemed to all have something incredibly unresolved. And they were damaged in some way very severely. As Mickey says, nobody really wanted to win this war. I mean, we were out there dying and killing, but they didn't want us to win, to really win, which now we know, of course, is true. Nobody did want to win the war, and in the end, we just walked away from it. Well, to think that 50,000 people lost their lives fighting for something that nobody had an interest in winning, it leaves you kind of breathless. So here is a man who, the real cop, did two tours as a Marine in Vietnam, and then spent the rest of his life in a homicide in the sheriff's department. When we would go through the city at night, I mean at night, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, he had X-ray vision. I mean, he said, you see, that was a dope deal. You see that? I mean, he would read things that you were totally unaware of. But he'd say one thing about people. He said, when you lay hands on someone on the street, you better grab them. In other words, if you grab somebody, they better know that they're grabbed. You don't just fool around with somebody. You don't just grab them by the... You grab them like you got them in a death lock. They better know they're grabbed. And that's the way Mickey, if you notice, he functions that way throughout the movie. When he does something physical, even sitting Tracy down, boom, he sits her down. When he opens the door, he slams it open. When he grabs somebody, he really grabs them. When he punches somebody, he gives it everything he has. Everything is venting, all of which is why I love that last line.
I just want to be with somebody tonight. I don't know anybody else. Isn't that a real laugh? I don't know anybody. I feel like such an asshole.
That's the real. That's why I wanted this set. I fought for this.
Did you hear what I said?
When we shot this, we got there in the middle of the night with just the cameraman, the grip assistant, just five people, because we wanted to get the blue light of this. That's for real. It's at dawn. This is the entire reason why I wanted to be up there. It's just a view of Manhattan that you never see. It's all of Wall Street, the Twin Towers. It's kind of amazing. They're right there, the Twin Towers. There they are. That, to me, is a wonderful, beautiful shot of New York that you don't see, have never seen in any other movie. Suddenly we're in Bangkok, the Chao Phraya River.
It was bad enough doing business with the old general, that double-dealing slime. But Van Sung's even worse.
She loses all face by going up there to deal with him direct. Van Sung's got an ego like a fucking octopus.
I know, but I don't trust his agent here.
This is Ben's White Panama.
150 to 200 tons. I'm offering him 6,000 a key, plus a shipment of Kalashnikov assault rifles.
Hey!
Hey, Marshal!
Hey,
yeah, yeah.
Killing you, man. How's it going?
How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? How's it going? 让你杀害的消息之后，我心里很难过。你要知道，没有他老人的指导，咱们赚钱就没那么容易了。
I get along great with them. I don't know why. I get along with gangsters and kings, dictators, but I guess I can't deal with middle management. It's my downfall, high and low.
屎屁钻进去，吃内脏的臭乌鸦还不如，简直是太下流了，太卑鄙了。还有一个新的消息啊。
这小子最近在土壤多，又惹是生非，是吗？太不像话了！你放心，像这种臭乌鸦，我不会把它放在眼里的。马兄，你这样一说，我真是茅塞顿开了。我想我们应该补充一点消息。Anytime
you're on water, it's the most difficult kind of shooting there is. See, all these boats are choreographed. That's not just the normal traffic. They're choreographed to come through at key points in the dialogue. There's one assistant just cueing the boats. And that's really what you see in that place. It's not, as I said, there's no green screen, there's no trickery. Now you're back in Greenpoint. Now you could see the church. See, that's the cathedral where the Pope said Mass in the largest Polish community in America. See, you can hear someone say good morning in Polish.
We open the door. You open the door, what do I got to do, break it down? We gotta clear the air between us. We gotta talk it out.
So talk.
I don't know what got into me with this Chinese.
This is set. So you went from Brooklyn back to a set in Wilmington.
Then.
So what do you want me to say? Do you want me to forgive you, Stanley? Is that what you want?
Hard to believe with all this detail we came in 8 days ahead.
The truth is, I don't know what I want.
You want to marry her? You want to have babies with her?
Look, I didn't plan for things to happen this way.
I never use storyboards. That's for directors who can't see. I choreograph it, but I don't use storyboards. How can you lock yourself into a picture? It's like painting by numbers. It looks stilted. I want to be free in a space and move the camera and shoot wherever I want to shoot and be free to choose any angle. I don't want to be locked into some preconceived picture. The movie is dead that way.
You're going to go off and have babies with a woman 10 years younger than me. I don't have any pity for you, Stanley. I hope you feel bad.
Why don't we just let things ride for a while? Just let some time pass.
I don't have any time.
I just need some time to think.
I'm out of time. I'm 35, sliding into 40.
So what do you want me to do? You want me to just walk away just like that?
I love a single guitar with an orchestral background, which I used also in Deer Hunter. Before this, That was the great John Williams. Strings and guitar go wonderfully well together.
Now, will you get out of here before I start to cry? And I don't want to do that. Not in front of you. I got my pride.
Now you're back outside. See, you're back in Brooklyn. So in one cut, you go from a set to real exterior. Real washing on the clotheslines. When you kill somebody, it's not exactly pleasant. It's a mess. I mean, think of the Nicole Simpson thing. People have always said, I'm violent, but I'm not violent. I'm not a violent person. And what I show is not to sensationalize violence, but simply to give you the facts. This goes back and forth between Wilmington and Brooklyn. That church is a painted background, because this is Wilmington now. It's like a war story and a Western. That's Burma. You're looking at Burma. I found this truck on a recce in a village. It looks just like that. It was a chicken coop. So I loved it with all that junk on it. And I said, let's put an engine in this and use it. Because for me, a vehicle in a movie is like a character. Every car has to be chosen. You can't just say, get me a truck. This truck is unique. It has a personality. It's like a horse. You know, everything in the frame, you put in the frame. So if you're putting a vehicle in there, it's got to be appropriate to, you can't put a Nissan Pathfinder in there or a Range Rover. It would be ridiculous. This is really, really, really in the north. One way is China, another way is Laos, and the other way is Burma. You're right on the edge. You're at literally the top of Thailand. Nobody ever goes there. This is a special tribe that lives there. I believe they're called the Akha. This shot had to be planned before, on the recce, before we ever came back, because this is all on a giant dolly with a crane, the shot. So that those tracks had to be positioned 6 or 7 months before we ever arrived. See, it's all one shot. This is the way they live. This is not acting. This is not SCG Hollywood.
Long time no see, Jotai.
This is a kid from New York who never acted in his life. He worked as a waiter also. There was the one part I was desperate about, and we weren't finding anybody. We were in New York in the production office, and we kept seeing all these non-professionals. This one kid came in. I think he worked in a restaurant. Most of them did, in one way or another. And I loved his look. He looked like Ban Sung to me. He looked right. You know, a lot of them are half-breeds, a mixture of Chinese and Japanese. But he just had features that looked right to me. They were rugged. They were foreign. They weren't American. And I wanted a face that looked believable in the high mountains, in the jungles. So this kid came in. So I had him read and come back like the old man in the Bean Sprout Factory. Come back and come back and come back and come back. I had John work with him. And we kept working with him right up to the point that we had to leave to go to Thailand. And I was still worried to death that he wasn't going to carry it off. And if he didn't carry it off, the movie would have ended right there. I had misgivings up until the last moment. And then strange thing happened. I had to go up to the very north of Thailand, to the northernmost army outpost, which has, I don't know, 20,000 guys, I suppose. And I had to make a negotiation with the general to get the troops I needed for that scene and also for protection, because it's a war zone, literally, still today. Because you got the gun runners from Laos, you got the drug people in Burma, you got Chinese. It's an active war zone. People are being killed every single day up there. Hard to believe, but it's true. In fact, descendants of Chiang Kai-shek's army have built an entire city up there. It's the 100-and-something division. It's a famous division. It's the division of Chiang Kai-shek's army. They built a town in Thailand, and they still walk around carrying weapons. It's like a state within a state. It's the most amazing thing. They wear uniforms. They salute. They've intermarried with Thai and Burmese women, and they built a residence for the Chinese being Chinese, which is being smart, built a formal residence for the Thai premier or ambassador or whoever, but they're completely self-sufficient. It's rather amazing. Anyway, we drove up, and I took John with me, and I took this fellow who plays Ban Sung with me because I wanted them to meet the real army people. So I went up to see the general, and John and the other guy were looking around amazed that this is for real. It's like a war time. This is the headquarters. These guys are on the front. And I wanted the kid who plays Ban Sung to just see military bearing so he could conduct himself. He says, Yukio, you see these guys? You're one of these guys. Everybody had a shaved head, you know, shaved on the sides. Something gave me an inspiration. I don't know what it was. I said, General, do me a favor. I said, have your barber give this kid a military haircut. And John, go with him. So while they went off to the barber shop, I went to sit with the general. So he said, Michael, before we get to business, let us have a cup of tea. We had a cup of tea while Yukio is getting his head sandblasted. He's come outside with me, Michael. And we go outside, and I notice the whole base is standing formation, full formation with weapons. What's this? And we're walking. And as we walk closer, everybody snaps to attention. And I think, what is he leading me up to here? And we go up. And as we get up to the first line, he made me walk with him to review the troops. You know, like you see Clinton or Bush walk along, you know, when reviewing foreign troops. And behind them, I see this giant banner, one in Thai and one in English. It says, welcome back to Thailand, Michael Cimino. I was so moved. I had tears in my eyes. So we reviewed the troops with the general. I saluted him, you know. And then he asked me to get up to address the troops, which I did. I mean, I was so touched because I'm an honorary colonel in the Thai Air Force. Anyway, it was beautiful. I was very moved, very touched. We made the deal. And just as we come back to his place, Yukio comes back with John. Yukio was transformed. He became this character. Something about that goddamn haircut. I don't know what it was, but suddenly he was released. And he became Bansung. A haircut. Just a haircut. And that's a performance by someone who still doesn't act. I don't know what happened. It was a mystical transformation that I always think about. People say, how did you get the performance? I gave him a haircut. It sounds ridiculous, but it worked.
A nasza rozłąka ze zmarłymi jest przejściowa. Jeśli zachowasz pamięć o grzechu, Panie, któż się ostoi, Panie, udzielasz przebaczenia, aby Ci ze czcią usłużono. Bóg miłosierny daje
beautiful music. It's such an interesting phenomenon to me that wedding music, i.e. the Deer Hunter, and funeral music are both so exquisite.
She looks beautiful, Stan.
This may be the Resurrection Symphony. I'm not sure. Mahler. I love Mahler. It might be. I think it is. The horns. I think it's Mahler, the Resurrection Symphony.
My deepest condolences to you, Mr. White.
The most beautiful comment I've ever had on any movie I've made was at dinner with Zubin Mehta. That's the man from the bean sprout factory. Zubin had just seen Heaven's Gate, and he said to me it was like watching Mahler. And it took my breath away because Mahler happens to be one of my very favorites. I just published my second novel in Paris, and I'm quite excited about that, and I'm waiting for news on the third. That has me really excited, and I've done a new screenplay, which I'm going to attempt to do. But, you know, it's interesting. Even before I made this movie, I have been saying to American people, China is the future. If the 18th century was Britain and the 20th century was American, the 21st is going to be the Chinese century. And that seems to be happening. People used to say I was crazy. But, you know, half of Beverly Hills is owned by Chinese interest. The Beverly Wilshire, Rodeo Drive, you go on Rodeo Drive shopping, it's all Chinese women. Go to clubs at night, all the great-looking girls are Chinese. And not Japanese, Chinese. You go to Seattle, the airport signs in L.A., they're in Spanish and English. In Seattle, they're in Chinese and English. All the musicians at Juilliard now are no longer Jewish. They're Chinese. And they have such an amazing work ethic. One of the reasons I love working with Chinese people so much is they really work. These are people used to working 20 hours a day. They're not complaining and groaning like Americans. You know, when's our coffee break? When's our lunch? You know, they never complain. They're the most wonderful people to work with. And I can understand how they built the American railroads. And as Mickey says, you know, we wouldn't have the railroads without the Chinese. We would not. and we still ride on their labor. And I've always felt China was going to play an important part of the future. And I think we will live to see the day when a Chinese American is in a very important political position in Washington. They have traditionally avoided it. They've been backers behind the scenes, but they're beginning to step up. And once they step up, there's no stopping them. And the Koreans, too, the same way. But it's the same, that Oriental ethic. But the Koreans now have come clear up to Beverly Hills. It's no longer Koreatown. It's going to be Korea LA. You know, it's going to be Korean. And it's interesting because New York, Tokyo, and Peking are all on the same latitude, which is kind of amazing. So I have always been somehow attracted to things Chinese. And I guess for me, this was a chance to begin to explore it on a contemporary level. I always start a movie, if I'm going to insinuate myself into another culture, whether it's Irish or Sicilian or particularly Irish or Chinese, I begin by reading the poets like Li Po, sometimes called Li Pai, who's one of the most famous Chinese poets. If you read the poets and you listen to the music and you learn about the legends, when I was preparing to do Michael Collins, when I was working with Robert Bolt, which we didn't do, I spent countless hours reading Yeats. I read Yeats so much on that project that I started to know a number of the shorter poems by heart. In fact, we were on our way to have a meeting of the Irish Parliament to get permission to use the army, which we got. And we got off the plane, and there were several of us. We piled into a cab, my production manager, art director, and so forth. We got into a cab, and the Irish, you know, they're talking a mile a minute. And everybody in the country knew that we were there to do the Michael Collins. And since he's such a great figure, I mean, we had Bono and Geldof sitting outside the office waiting to try and do the music, you know. So I was reading Yeats on the plane. I closed the book, begin to the car, and this driver says, "You'll be the film people, are you?" And he said, "Yes, we are." You know, I'm just shrinking back in my seat. The other guys are talking. And he says, "Ah." Well, he said, you know, he goes on to an eloquent reason why he should be an actor and he should be in the movie. And I said, "Oh, so you can act?" He said, "Oh, yes." He says, "Yes, I can act. You know, I can't do the accent." So he begins on this beautifully, blindingly bright Irish day before we get to Parliament. And he begins reciting a Yeats poem. Well, it just happened to be the very same poem I was reading on the plane when I closed the book. So he does the poem, and he does it quite beautifully. He stops, like to say, "You see?" I waited a beat, and I said, "You left out the last line." "I beg your pardon, Yank." I said, "You left out the last line." He said, "I did not." I said, "Yes, you did." He said, "Well, what is it then?" And I gave it to him. It was so much fun. And he was like, he didn't say a word. He was poleaxed, you know. So in this case, I read a lot of Li Po or Li Pai, and I grew to love him. And I read him now, even long after this movie is made. And then you read so much about, in Ireland, you read about the legends and the old kings and in Sicily. They're such interesting places. I mean, there's nowhere in the world that you go that is not interesting. And my approach is to insinuate myself into the culture as much as I can. That's why sometimes it's hard for me to remember certain things. Because when I'm doing gangs in L.A., I'm really into the gang culture. I mean, I got to where I could read graffiti on the walls. I would go to rap clubs, and I mean, that's all that would be on my car is rap music, and I drench myself in the culture. And it's hard to undrench yourself. And just as you're doing that, you're inserting yourself into yet again a new culture. So to go from Sicily, which is such an amazingly rich culture, Arabic, Norman, I mean, that country has been invaded by everybody. To go from that to Ireland, with its incredible layers of legend and the old kings and the myths and the wonderful names, and that sometimes you get confused a little culturally. You know, you have to, like, kind of blot out everything you've learned about the one culture and take in the new. And just as you've gotten that, you're getting into yet another one. And that's true of every movie. It doesn't really matter. It's a bit like a woman. You can learn from her, but to really learn from her, if she's teaching you something, you have to fall a little bit in love, or a lot in love. And each time you go to one of these places, you end up with a love affair. I don't know why. Maybe that's just me. Or maybe it's something I learned from Clint. It rubbed off. But you can't help but fall in love in these cultures because you become so much a part of it. Like these Chinese girls, Doreen. You have to love her. There's no way not to. I mean, she's so charming and smart and tough. What's not to like? You know, a tough, smart, streetwise, street-smart girl, you know, who's slender as a blade of grass and sharp as a knife. You can't help but fall in love. And I think that's a part of making movies, too. I think falling in love is very much a part of filmmaking. It's something that nobody ever talks about for some reason. But you do need to fall in love when you make a movie. I don't know why. Perhaps it's my own defect. But I'm sure women don't like hearing this. I don't know if you would hear the same thing from a female director or not, but maybe it's true. But I know that it's a wonderful thing because it's not that you're doing it in order to learn more, but you do end up learning more by doing it. You come closer. You become at one in a very crazy way. You become at one with the milieu. It's so easy. I don't know why. It's just there's so many gorgeous people around, you know, that it's irresistible.
Pick it up.
我哋好不利，跟住会点呢？系唔系我哋啲相片啊，为咗报纸出现呢？你个新闻记者呢，点知道呢？泰国嘅事情呢？呢个系好严重嘅问题，令到我好担心，令到啊南宋堂啊对白粉马非常满意，好唔满意。仲有啊，我哋嗰班老朋友，嗰啲意大利人。
而家好嬲。喂，同你讲嘛，你思想真嘅厉害啦，咁大胆同佢自己出去打识个绿衣头都唔系，而家打唔死添。Throughout,
in addition to everything else, is the young-old theme, the betrayal of the young by the old, which we see today.
我哋自己啲嘢咧，冚唪唥都唔理。你唔入府，你点攞到府事啊，哥？你成晚呃嚟呃去，我唔知呃乜嘢。你讲乜契弟啊？你讲笑话，费佢啲。阿叔，你听我讲，Toronto 呢班人系小事嚟。啊，小事，好容易就搞掂噶啦。嗱，你哋Italian咧系另外一件事。我哋同黑人整好晒咧，又同我哋合作噶啦。I
guess this was really politically incorrect.
由佢讲啫嘛，冇所谓啊。 六醫好似一粒烏蠅喺大便度屎忽咬一啖，唔使理佢啊，我搞掂噶啦。哎呀，俾你搞掂啦。嗱，阿叔呢批貨，星期二咧就到咗 Bangkok。佢星期六咧已經到咗Amsterdam噶啦，我哋同我chemist喺香港講好曬啦。佢擔保我哋兩個禮拜一批貨。阿叔你諗一諗，阿旺伯一年先至做得到咧，我三個月就全部搞好曬。
三個月，車大炮。
咁而家嗰批貨幾時到紐約啊？一個禮拜以內，我哋啲錢啊喺銀行嗰度已經全部預備好晒。我哋星期一咧就下個禮拜星期就可以攞到噶啦。嗱，阿生，我問你哋啲仲想點樣？All
of John's clothes are handmade by the best tailor in New York. He's always meticulous.
等一個月唔得咩？等得㗎，哥，你而家送翻去 Harlem 仲係危險㗎嘛？你哋唔使擔心啊，所以我對我送貨人好有信任，我信得佢哋，你哋我搞好曬。
咁我哋呢一次係咪又同 Rising Sun 公司合作？
係，係個新嘅公司。
咩新嘅公司啊？
See, just that blinking light from outside, it gives air.
Oh, shit! Goddamn name of the ship!
Boyd has a wire in your office.
Who?
I don't know, but I'm going to find out.
Hey, Perez. I don't want anything to go wrong with this ship, and it's important to me.
Don't worry.
I want you at the pier.
All right, where?
The Kazimierz Poleski. Holy shit, that's Tuesday. Pier 11.
I'll be there.
Thanks.
Proof of what you can do without dialogue. This is New York. Notice he dropped the gun? That's what you do. Then the police have nothing to follow. This is New York, all New York. So they could only get that frame in New York.
You're gonna be all right. I'm proud as hell of you.
And it's based on an incident that happened in a situation like this where the man kept running and he was shot 7 or 8, 9 times. It's just the way a shooting goes down.
You got the bomb.
This is New York, club in New York on 2nd Avenue. It's all choreographed on the dolly. All this. All of this. Besides, it's incredibly dopey looking to handhold anamorphic. It's too wide. It would make you dizzy.
Come on, I'll stand.
Wall Street area, Vancouver, New York, Wall Street again, Wall Street. See how well those girls shoot? I didn't have to show them that. Oh, Doreen, baby, don't go.
You look like you're gonna die, beautiful.
Oh, yeah? Don't count on it.
You're not gonna make it. Is it worth it? You got anything you wanna tell me? Where you go, sweetheart?
Yeah, fuck you!
Check this up, check. What happened, Captain? Captain, what the hell happened?
Park downtown. I love the mood of this particular shot. I think we caught it just right. Famous butterfly knives. Here, the small thing is that in most movies, you would never see Joey Tai bandaged after a fight. He had his nose smashed by Mickey so hard, it had to be broken. You'd probably normally just see a little, if anything.
Hey, my friend.
Harry, I'm going to go for the honor.
令到Harry加上他個人的惡感。如果我錯,我一定立刻搞定他了,但是做這些事,做這些事,對於沒有人有益的。
To me, film is film. It's not foreign, it's not American. I don't make those distinctions.
你們現在不信得過我。無論如何, 我擔保你哋你冇損失嘅，我親自會去碼頭攞貨。
Look, I'm talking about one ship out of Rotterdam, the Kazimierz Pulaski.
This is the port of Wilmington. Wilmington happens to be one of the biggest ports in America, and not many people know that.
You know how big that ship is, Stanley? We can't go running around ripping up floor plates, cutting boilers open, poking through 10,000 Edam cheeses. Are drilling in a shipment of Danish furniture on your say-so, Stanley? It's a lot of money involved. We got passengers. We got waiting time. Besides, it's the flagship of a foreign government.
Hey, look, all I'm asking you to do...
One time years ago, when I was doing commercials, I was chasing this one girl at some nightclub in New York. I forgot the hell the name of it. Some dance club, I don't know what. And I came on really strong with this one gal. And she gives me a look and she says, what do you do? And I had just done a couple of commercials. I said, well, I'm a director. She looked at me without moving, and she said, what do you direct, traffic? Do you know from that day, I have never said to anyone, I'm a director, ever. I fly on planes. People say, what do you do? I said, I'm a real estate developer. Oh, where do you do that? In South Florida, do condominiums. One time I was on a plane with Celeste Holm. It's on an American flight to New York. I love her as an actress. She was wonderful in everything she's ever done. Intelligent, witty, great woman. She's sitting to my left, and I'm sitting on the aisle. She's near the window. Now we're flying for a couple of hours, and she glances over at me. She says, I know who you are. I said, oh? She said, yes, I think I know who you are. I said, I don't think so. So she said, what do you do? I said, I develop real estate. Oh, where? But with that smile that she had, you know, that knowing smile, I said, South Florida, condos, you know, blah, 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 commercial property. Where do you live? Coconut Grove. I'm just here on business, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I tried to cut the conversation dead because of this directing. I didn't want to say I was a director. And I know she knew who I was, you know. So we're disembarking from the plane, and she turns around, she gives me this sly look, and she said, I know who you are. And she went on ahead.
God damn you, Stanley. I was almost killed for you. I was raped, and I'm not going to die for you. I'm not
business are you? Who?
Rape is rape.
Who? Who raped
Three
you?
Three boys.
Who?
Three boys.
Who raped you?
Three Chinese boys, Stanley.
You went too far this time, that fucking Joey.
It didn't happen to you. It happened to me. You don't give a shit about me, do you?
She gave everything she had here, Ariane.
Leave, Stanley. Go away and leave me alone. You should take a look at yourself, Stanley. You're selfish. You're callous. You're indifferent to suffering. Your wife was right. And you still don't get the message. How many more people are you gonna kill before you do?
I worked so hard with her on that, but she came through.
Just go away, leave me alone. Don't say anything, just go away!
You know, for a non-professional, she did pretty well here. Working with Ariane in that scene where Mickey really rips her, I mean, you're pushing her to the very limit. You're pushing her to break down. It's so intimate. I mean, for me, writing and rehearsal are such intimate parts of making a movie. You see, I like all parts of making a movie. There's some directors who hate being on the set. They hate it. They love to be in the editing room. They love to putz around with the writer. But they hate to be out in the cold or the heat or the bugs. I love being out of doors with a movie. I don't like being on a stage. I'd always rather be outside and preferably in the mountains or someplace. But I like every part of it. I love the writing of it. I love the research of it. I love the recce because you get to see an entire country. I went to Korea a couple of years ago. I saw all of South Korea, every single part of it. I went to every town, every place. It was great. It was absolutely great. I had an instant cultural compression. I loved the shooting of it. I loved the rehearsal. I loved the finishing. And best of all, I loved sinking into a nice plush leather couch during the recording of the track when you got the whole L.A. fill behind the glass in front of you with the composer doing all the work, and you sit there and suddenly you see this music come on the screen and you say, oh my, and it's a black and white print. And you think for the first time, I really made a movie. My God, it looks like a movie up there. And it's like, you feel like you're about 12. And it's the first time it occurs to you that you've done a movie. It's my favorite. I love it. But to get there, you bleed and you sweat and you hurt and you go through all kinds of things. But to me, it's like the cherry on top of the whipped cream on top of the sundae. That moment when you're just in this black couch looking through the glass and you see the anamorphic image in black and white and you see music and you say, I've done that. It's a movie. It's sublime. Really sublime moment. The best moment in movies, I think.
On the ship, and you walk out of here with a head start.
Hey, stand white, you cops!
Shot through the hand like Christ. It's Wilmington.
Yeah.
Now, that's a for real locomotive coming at that speed. And I couldn't get that Mercedes wouldn't even get a dent in it. I thought it was going to crush it. And it didn't. We ended up chaining the Mercedes to the ties, and it still wouldn't dent it. And I hit it with an entire train. Finally, I had 20 stuntmen with sledgehammers beating it up. I was so impressed, I bought one as soon as I got home.
Come on!
This is the classic Western. Joey reverts to the thug he is. I love the aspect of the two warriors because they've been in a war. And I love the fact that as two warriors that Mickey gives them the opportunity of killing himself in an honorable way. Because he could have just blown him away right there or captured him. But he gives Joey the chance of committing suicide.
Tell me where it is!
Mercedes. Please.
Hands him the weapon. This is part of, I think, what gives it human dimension. Is that he trusts him, he trusts an aspect of Joey that is honorable.
There are those who liken Chinatown to a skating pond. On the surface, we see a lovely picture postcard landscape of snowflakes and skaters.
And you can see there's so many non-actors everywhere. It's hard for me to pick them all out, but I've always loved, in every movie I've done, I've loved working with non-professional people. That is, people who are non-actors. I think everybody in some way is an actor because everybody acts different parts in life. But there's something about non-professionals used in the right way, in the right context, with the right actors, that gives you something which is fresh and refreshing.
The Hun Sang Association, resulting in the removal of Captain Stanley White. One wonders if this is not a smokescreen to distract from the main issue, which is what part the Hun Sang.
Now, here's Joey. So it goes in a circle. Now, here's Joey's portrait as we began with the old generation. Now, the new generation goes. And this, of course, is the set still. Now, here's Stanley. Even after the fighting is done, he won't stop.
Stop! White! God damn it, White! What the hell is going on?
I'm arresting these people!
He has to fight even after the fight is over. Because he sees it still going on. Nothing stopped, even though he got the guy. This is a mixture of kids, street people. They just add a texture, I guess. It's like spices with food, different spices, mixture of things, sweet, sour. And I believe this is Resurrection Symphony. Now, here's the critical line, which has changed.
You know,
I guess if you fight a war long enough, nice you marry the enemy.
I just don't know how to be nice.
You're really cracked, you know that?
I think it was the producer's or studio's attempt to be politically correct as it could be. But if you rerun it, you'll see that his mouth is not making those words. That was my greatest regret on the movie, that that line was changed, because I felt it summed up the movie. I guess if you fight a war long enough, you end up marrying the enemy. Boom. That's the proper, right, correct ending. And that I wish I could change it. I wish I could change it. Because it deserves that line. Because it's a line that Oliver believes in, I believe in, you know. It was criminal to change that line. I can't tell you how much that irritates me and hurts me to this day that that line is not there. It's fun to have done this with you. It's fun to see that it's still so contemporary. Well, it's more contemporary now than it was then. And it's so alive and crisp. And we're watching it on a crappy TV monitor, and it still looks sparkling. You know, it's like newly fallen snow. It has that glisten to it.
Tiếng mi